There are new discussions now about what people are calling advanced metrics, ways of measuring all kinds of things, measuring real people as though you are measuring actors on a video game or something like this, and it gets very complicated. People are torn as to, are advanced metrics helpful or not? Do they mean anything or not? But we measure things. As a pastor, I am not overly concerned with your batting average or your graduation rate or your conversion ratio. Those are important things because they make the difference between whether or not you have a job and whether or not you can get it. That's all very important, but that's not what I go to bed at night worried about. Now, what you go to bed worried about is probably very important, but not to me. What is important to me? What is important to me are the kind of things that Paul outlines in these three verses that we're looking at. I want to call this message today my prayer for Faith Baptist Church, because as I've meditated on this passage of Scripture, it has challenged me in the goals that I need to have for each one of you and for all of us together. And I trust that I'll also speak on behalf of Brother Johnson and the pastor out there in Glen Estee, Ohio, speaking to the young people and the folks of that church here today. Paul, as the spiritual leader of this church, and not just as an apostle, but as somebody spiritually burdened for the oversight of this group, he prayed for them in particular ways and outlined some burdens that he had for them. And they really do tell you a little bit about what I go to bed at night worried about, burdened about, concerned about. What am I measuring? What am I aiming for? What is on my heart most when I think about you all, when I thank God for you all, and when I pray for you all? I am praying for you in the same way that Paul prayed for the believers at Philippi. Number one, I am praying that you will overflow in responsible love. I am praying that you will overflow in responsible love. Philippians chapter 1 and verse 9 says, "And this I pray, that your love may abound yet more and more." I am praying that you will abound in love. I don't know that I will ever be satisfied with the amount of love that we have at Faith Baptist Church. Just to be honest with you, as a pastor, I'm probably always going to want a little bit more. Is that okay? That's not good leadership. Good leadership does not create open-ended goals. Good leadership lays out, if you understand these things, you've read books about this, you lay out reachable goals, goals that are reachable, goals that can be obtained, not impossible goals. But I'm laying out for you a goal that probably is not fully reachable, and that is that your love may increase more and more and more and more and more and more and more. That is what Paul is saying. I am praying that you will overflow in love. Love for what or love for who? The fact is, Paul doesn't answer that question. He just says in an open-ended way, I am praying that your love would abound more and more and more. Love for what? Because our love demands an object. You have to love something. He's not talking about a feeling. The word for love is, in this case, it's unconditional, strong love, a love that does not go away when hard times come. People leave churches for a lot of reasons. And some of those reasons sound more important than others. One reason a person might leave a church is because somebody didn't shake their hand on a Sunday morning when they showed up. Some people leave churches because they didn't like the fact that we painted the trim instead of left it the natural stain color. Some people might leave a church because they weren't recognized for the work that they spent in working at the church over the weekend, and the pastor didn't notice that in public. Maybe the pastor could have or should have. Some people will leave church for more noble reasons, like hypocrisy. Well, so-and-so says this, but you know what that person needs? That person needs some love. You need to reach out to that person and keep on coming back to present yourself in a way that makes a difference. Paul here provides no specific object. He does not say that your love for God may abound more and more, or he doesn't say that your love for one another may abound yet more and more, or your love for your job or your love for your family. He doesn't answer that question. All he does is say that your love would abound. I suspect, one man says, as I studied, he says, I suspect that he leaves the object open precisely because he would not want to restrict his prayer to one or the other. He's not wanting you to get a limited view of loving God or just loving people or loving something, because it's all the same. If you love God, you will love one another. If you love one another, it will only come out of a love for God, a commitment that does not stop, a commitment that bears a large degree of hurt even, and disappointments. God here is telling us that our love is supposed to be a commitment to one another and to Him that increases more and more and more and more and more. But He doesn't just stop there. He describes the kind of love, not so much in the object, but in the quality. What kind of love? And let me explain it to you this way. There are a lot of things to hug in life. When you're a young child, you love to hug teddy bears and these kind of things, right? For me, it was a monkey. My huggable animal was a monkey. His name was Zippy. Zippy the monkey. And this guy got so much love for me that his hair came off and his clothing fell apart. And so my mom took me to Toys R Us, and she took me down the Cabbage Patch aisle because that was the right size for this guy. And we got a new outfit for him. And she took my dad's old Letterman jacket that was very old, and she cut a piece of cloth out of that and sewed it onto his head and gave him new hair. He turned into a red-headed monkey at that point. It's because I hugged him a lot. I loved Zippy when I was a kid. He was a special, special stuffed animal. And I won't ask him of you men here, I won't ask Mike what his stuffed animal was growing up. I'm sure he would tell you. But I want to encourage you along this line. There are a lot of good things to hug, and they may not all necessarily be sinful, but let me recommend that you don't hug a porcupine. You see, there's nothing wrong with hugging a porcupine, Pastor. Nothing at all. There's no sin in that. It's an animal like all the rest. It's got a cute little face like all the rest, and it has looks furry and all these kind of things, and it's just requiring that I give it a hug, right? Just because it's not sin does not necessarily mean that you embrace it. Be careful that you don't hug a porcupine. Why am I saying that? Well, let me explain that here. As I pray that your love will continue to overflow more and more for God and for one another, I'm praying that you will overflow in responsible love. There are a lot of things said today about love in secular culture as well as in Christian culture, and it's sometimes very misunderstanding. Love is not just a blanket acceptance of anything or anyone in particular in every way possible. Love must be informed. The Bible says here, I am praying that your love will abound yet more and more in knowledge. I am praying for you all that you will abound in a responsible love, knowing what is true. Knowing what is true. There are issues today that are being promoted, and they're being promoted on this kind of a premise. That if you love somebody, that's all you need to know. If you love somebody, that makes anything you want to do okay. Do you understand what I'm talking about? And even in courts of law, the argument of love is being made, and it's being attached to constitutional issues. And let me just say this, that some very bad things can be passed off in the name and the argument of love. Love that is not informed by what is true. Love must be hedged in. Love must be guarded and defined by what is true. Again, reading in my study this week, another man said, of course, Paul is not thinking of just any kind of knowledge here. He is not hoping that these people will learn more and more about nuclear physics or sea turtles. He has in mind the kind of knowledge of God. He wants them to enjoy insight into God's words, into God's ways. There are a lot of things to know in this world. Google makes that possible. Wikipedia makes that possible. Universities and colleges on every corner make this possible. Libraries make this possible. But not all knowledge is true knowledge. And can I present to you that what caused Adam and Eve to fall, in part, was a misunderstanding of knowing what is true? In fact, Satan said, there are more things to know, and you need to know them so you can be like God. Only God can handle certain kinds of information. We don't need to know everything. We just need to know what is true. And we need a lot more of that. Let me challenge you, if you have not spent time in the Word of God this week at all, you are probably lacking in the matter of knowing what is true. You say, well, I learned all that stuff in school, or I've been to church, and I have a good teaching church, and Pastor Sawyer has laid a good foundation and all of this. You need to personalize this knowledge. You need to take this knowledge seriously. You have pursued knowledge this week. You have pursued information this week. You've studied something. You studied the newspaper. You studied your Google News page. Or you've studied the cable. That's a great place to get information there. Discovery Channel, maybe. But I mean, there's so many things to study. You studied how to, you know, beat this particular computer game. Or you studied how to improve yourself on the job. Or maybe more noble things, like you tried to study how to know your wife a little bit better. That's a good thing to do, men. Or folks, the Ohio team, maybe you've studied how to be a better witness or how to do face painting for the Lord and these kind of things, right? There are things that you've studied, you've paid attention to. How much have you studied God? How much have you paid attention to Him? You ever stand at a distance and watch an anthill? You watch a bunch of ants running around on the sidewalk, scurrying around, carrying a little piece of broken leaf, or picking up a dead ant or some other dead bug and carrying it around, or running back and forth, forming a line, trying to find another place to build a colony and building up this little pile. You ever stand and watch an ant pile? What's the only way, really, to get those ants to pay attention to you? To you. To step on them. And I wonder if God doesn't feel that way Himself sometimes. As He looks down, we're worrying about our numbers and our things that we own and our goals and our accomplishments and the tasks that we have to do. And some of those are important things. The Bible uses ants as an example of an appropriate work ethic. Not lazy. But does God have to step on you to get you to study Him and to take Him seriously? Or do you pay attention to Him because you just love Him and you can't get enough of God? You want to blame other people for hypocrisy? Just look in the mirror and ask yourself the question before I criticize anyone of being a hypocrite. How much have I studied God and paid attention to Him this week? Oh, as your pastor, I am praying for you all that your love will abound in knowledge, that you will study God and study Him more than ever before and fall in love with Him more than ever before. And you know what I know will happen? You'll begin to love one another a whole lot more. And this thing is like a waterfall that will spill over, and continue to do it. I am praying that you will overflow in responsible love. Love that is knowing what is true. Number two, love that is understanding what is appropriate. Love that understands what is appropriate. Verse 9, and this I pray, that your love may abound yet more and more in knowledge and in all judgments. I am not just praying that you will know more things about God and observe more things about God and one another. I'm also praying that you'll be able to take that knowledge and to practice it in a meaningful way, to let that information change your life. I talked to a missionary one time who talked to a missionary, and the missionary that he had talked to was asked the question. This man was a missionary in Brazil for, 30, 40 years. He had planted churches, many, many churches. He had started Bible colleges, more than one. And he was a very fruitful person. A lot of years of experience in Brazil, speaking Portuguese. And he said, he was asked the question, if you could do one thing over in life, what would you do? And he said, that's a very easy question. At this stage, looking back in my life, I would have taught my people how to apply things. He said, I was very good at preaching the Bible and presenting information and loading people up with the facts of the case of what the Bible is making. And he said, I assumed that they would just soak it in and go home and do something about it. And they usually didn't. They usually got in their cars and drove home or got in their bikes and pedaled home or walked home or whatever the case might be. And moved on with life and waited for God to do something drastic. They didn't just do something with it. We're afraid to make choices. We're afraid to button things up a little bit more. We're afraid to get specific about what God is doing in our life. Men, I use this illustration a lot because it's an obvious illustration. You can tell your wife you love her all you want. You can think about her all you want. But what does she really want you to do with that information? Something about it. You say, maybe I'll be wrong. Maybe I'll get her chocolate and she doesn't like chocolate. Okay, don't be too worried about that, really. She can tell you she doesn't like chocolate and you can change later. The fact that you bought her something to show your love says more than just, I love you. I'll tell you this funny story. My wife, I like to get her things. And I probably bought her a dozen roses every week when we were courting and engaged and all of this. Looking back, I don't know. That was a good use of my money, I'm sure. $9.99 at Pick and Save. It was a pretty good deal. But my wife finally told me one day, she said, honey, I like roses. But I know that it costs money, and honestly, I'd prefer that you not buy them. Okay, that's a little awkward, right? Because what am I supposed to do? I want to do something, and part of my love language is giving. I like to give things. I think buying something for somebody is a way to say, I care about you. That's kind of me. Not everyone thinks that way, but that's me. That's another topic, the love languages. How many of you are familiar with that subject? It's interesting. It's helpful. And so what I've done now, I still buy her something now and then. She knows it's important for me to do that for my sake. But there are times, literally, I've gone to the store and I've walked into the store and I've walked up to the flowers and I've looked at them and I've studied them and I've figured out which one I want to buy, picked the bouquet out, and I've walked up to the cash register and I've walked back and put them away. And then I go home and I tell my wife, you know what? I almost bought you some roses today. I even picked them out and I took them to the cashier, but I put them away. Because I knew you didn't want me to spend the money. I went through the motions as far as I could and yet honored what she said, but I still did the actions to make the point. I had to do it probably more for me than for her. But I love telling her the story. God wants you to do something. And honestly, there will be times that I try to be specific. I have to be careful when I'm specific in the pulpit. Because if the Bible doesn't say something, I have to be careful that I honor that. At the same time, a good parent does not expect their children to only do the things they specifically say. They're waiting for that moment of maturity when they begin to make choices that are more careful and more responsible than what mom and dad said. A parent should not have to tell their child when they're 15 years old, please don't hang out with bad friends, especially this particular person. The kid should just know that. They shouldn't have to get nitty-gritty particular on things. And I want to be careful. I told you last week what some of my thoughts were about social media. I'm wrestling on these things. I can't tell you things that I have to deal with sometimes as a pastor that cause me to be concerned about the side effects that are negative regarding social media. I'm wrestling with those things. I also honor and respect the positive possibilities that are there for social media. And I'm torn. And I just want to expose that fact to you all as a pastor. That's my heart, and I'm laying it in front of you. Wrestle with these things. If you're going to use social media, go to the Bible and ask yourself, why? Have I thought about God in the process of making this decision? What are my God reasons for it? What are my Bible reasons for it? Have I laid out negatives? Have I even been willing, bold enough to consider the negatives? So we don't like walking through this process because it forces us to make love choices. And we have to face the fact that we love certain things more than God. We're not willing to let them go. He doesn't always take them away. Sometimes He does. And all I want to do is expose you to the process and challenge you to jump into the process and make choices based on knowledge that knows how to make appropriate decisions. Love doesn't just accept. Love discerns. Letter C. Not only am I burdened that you know what is true and that you approve or that you grow in judgment, but number three, I'm burdened that you may approve things that are excellent, verse 10. Approve things that are excellent. Otherwise, embracing what is best. The idea of excellent is the idea of judging, discerning, kind of being a judge and laying out options and looking at different opportunities and options in front of you and making the choice not what is okay, what is possible for me and how far can I go and still get away with it, or what's, you know, kind of safe, but what is definitely not sin and then I'll just leave it at that. But asking the question, this word excellent, what is superior? What, in fact, is extremely good, not just okay? How can I express my love to God by embracing what is extremely good and highly preferred and closest to His heart? I'm not trying to impress God. I'm not trying to earn brownie points with God. All I want to do is love Him. All I want. Husbands, if you go out and buy your wife flowers to make her impressed with you, that's wrong. You go out and you dress really nice to, you know, to kind of get her, you know, thinking you're really something special, that's wrong. You do those things because you love her. That you may approve things that are excellent. I asked my son several years ago, Josh. I asked him as a little tiny boy, I said, so if I could take you anywhere in the world, anywhere, and I figured he'd read enough books already and heard enough stories and that he had an idea of options that were there. I said, so son, if I could take you any place in the world, and it didn't matter how much it would cost or how hard it would be to get there or how difficult it would be to do, if I could take you anywhere, where would you go? I figured that would help me to understand the depths of my son's heart and, you know, bond us together. And he said, without thinking, McDonald's. Okay, we're going to save this question for a little bit later. And I said, so why? And in my mind, I'm thinking, you know, Germany or Disneyland or a castle somewhere or something, you know, a ship with the pirates. Or... He said, because they have a play place. McDonald's isn't dumb. As a pastor, sometimes I just get burdened that we're picking McDonald's. I'm not talking about food. Look, McDonald's is fine as long as you pray for your food. That's what the Bible says. Just in moderation. And moderation may be more or less for some people. There's liberty there. But let me say this. Why choose McDonald's when you have freely offered to you the best steakhouse or the best salad bar in town right across the street? Let me challenge all of us as a church to learn to choose what is extremely good. Some people call those kind of things being strict. Some people call those kind of things being overly careful or ultra conservative. We're fine with being politically conservative, but not spiritually conservative. I want God to lead you in the choices in life. None of us have arrived at a place where all of our choices are made and no more choices are to be made except for come to church. God wants to see our love grow in specific acts and practices of love that show that we're thinking about His merciful, gracious, holy, loving heart. And we want to draw near to Him. It is my desire as pastor. Oh, by the way, when we finish that story, I told Josh today, I said at breakfast, we were eating some blueberry muffins, and I said, you know, son, I think I'm going to give an illustration about you. And if he really didn't want me to, I probably wouldn't have done it. But I said, when you were a little boy, we had this discussion, and you picked McDonald's. He smiled. He said, if you asked me today, I'd pick something different. I said, what? The mission field. I said, which mission field? And Emily said, Africa. I know it's going to be Africa. He said, Asia. I said, son, I'm pleased with that. You are definitely growing up. And that's my burden for us as a church. 10 years from now, 20, 30, 40 years from now, if I'm still breathing and preaching, I would love to know when I go to bed, when I drive around town, when I walk to the store, that all the people of Faith Baptist Church are filtered throughout the city, choosing things that are excellent. Even changing some behaviors because they love Jesus just too much and they just want to show that love. Don't ask how far can I go, just say, I love Jesus. It's a hard question to ask, folks. What is extremely good? What is best? That's a hard question for me to ask myself because there's some things that I love just a little bit too much. And then I'll say, but liberty, Lord. And I'll say, yeah, I know. And so I'm going to be patient with you. Keep thinking about it. Sometimes I do, sometimes I probably don't. And he comes back, hey, would you think about this? I'm burdened that we think about these things in regards to our relationships. Relationship choices. Let us embrace and do what is extremely good. Use of time. I'm burdened that we learn to use our time focused on that which is extremely good. I'm burdened that we make choices regarding media that is extremely good. However God leads you, I'm just burdened that we think through these things. I'm burdened in our use of money that we make choices that are extremely good. Don't be quick, easy spenders. Don't respond to marketing like this. Think about what you're doing. Ask God, is this what you want me to do? Be a man of financial or a woman of financial principles. I'm burdened that in our occupation choices, in our life calling, and our educational pursuits, that we learn to draw near to God and make choices that are based upon what is extremely good. And as Paul is locked away in prison, struggling with the challenges and trials of being chained to a Roman guard in a foreign city, he's thinking about the church at Philippi, and he's praying for them that they would have love that knows God, love that is discerning and makes application choices with that knowledge, specific acts of love. And he's praying that they will act out their love in the ways that are extremely good. Every spiritual leader, every parent understands this. Do you want children who grew up just to be good kids, informed kids? Do you want kids to grow up just to be better than their peers? Or do you want children like Daniel, who refused the king's meat? And we could even make the case today that that was unnecessary. But God honored that. Because Daniel just flat out loved his God. He was going to go as far as he could to show that love. I tell you, that kind of love goes places, folks. We are convinced that as careful as we... if we're going to love the world, we kind of have to, you know, be kind of like them. God says, no. You just love me as far as possible, and I'll help you reach them. Daniel didn't play politics. Daniel just did what was extremely best. And God used it in such a way that he put him second in command, and at one point in command of a pagan empire. And he didn't try at all in the least to bend a culture. He sold his soul to God. And God put him in important places and used him. We are in a day and time, whether it be in ministry calling, in vocational calling, or political calling, we are living in a day and time where we have young people that are growing up with parents who have modeled and older folks in church who have modeled making choices based upon love that drives them to do what is extremely good. That is how leaders are made, and that is how disciples that impact the world are made. And I'm afraid that our churches are filled with grown-ups modeling to their young people how to just get along in this world, not make waves, and be a good person. That is not world-changing. That's vanilla. So let me encourage you, don't hug a porcupine when you can hug a teddy bear. Number two, not only am I praying that you will overflow in responsible love, I am praying that you will be prepared for the judgments. Victor is an accountant. Do we have any other accountants in this church? We have a couple others here. What you worry about when you go to bed at night, especially during tax season, is that you didn't make any mistakes. I hope that I represented that person well, or I balanced the books properly. Because if I didn't, I'm in trouble. Maybe my boss is in trouble, but I'm in trouble when my boss is in trouble. I need to make sure it's done right. Do we have any plumbers or electricians in here? You got to make sure you do it right, right? Because I couldn't do that. I would go to bed at night with dreams of good families' houses burning down because of some mistake that I made. It would bug me. I just couldn't do it. But you have to learn this ability to work hard to make sure that those things don't happen. The plumbing needs to be done right so as to code. And I could go down the list of things that we're doing. Educators who have people entrust their children to their care to educate them. That must be done well because that's a sacred trust. Raising these young people, educating them. When I go to bed at night, there are times, literally, that I feel the weight of every one of you. It's not a negative thing, it's just a real thing. And I envision each one of you standing before Jesus. And if you don't have a good showing, that reflects on what I was able to give you and how I was able to help you, because it's my responsibility to lead you forward. And even today, the things that I'm mentioning to you and challenging you with, they're not easy. But I feel compelled to, because I envision you standing before the Lord of the universe and giving an account for your life, for the stewardship that I gave you. None of you have to do that. Men will give an account for their families, for their jobs. Ladies, for their families, their children, their personal lives. Children, for themselves. But pastors have to give an account for the members of their flock. Each one. And I'm not trigger happy, you'll probably find that. But if I ever do talk to you and just try to encourage you along a line of a personal growth or application, take it from my heart. I've wrestled with it. I've thought about it. I've prayed about it. I've gone to the Word about it. But I only mention it not to be hard or mean, but because I envision you at the judgment. And I want to stand back and see every member of this church have a good report. I would love to stand back and see every member of this church present a life that was in love with Jesus, that left all kinds of things behind to prove it, that impacted lives for eternity, that made tough choices, that stuck out like a sore thumb for Jesus, that put their necks on the line, maybe lost jobs, maybe lost family and relatives because they loved Jesus more than everything else. That's what I'm burdened about, not okay Christians. People in love with God who make tough choices. And I just want to stand before God and say, God, I don't have much to say. Just look at my church. Look at my church. And I hope that it was all that you wanted it to be. That's my prayer, This is not just my preaching. This is my prayer. This is what I pray for you all. When I don't have a specific request, I go back to this in part and I pray through these principles and ask God to do it. And you know what it means to you. I don't. He says that you'll be prepared for the judgment till the day of Christ. Letter A, growing in genuine purity. Praying that in being prepared for the day of Christ, you will be sincere. This is the idea of purity. If you hold something up that has a translucent quality, the idea of this word is holding up to the sunlight and letting the sunlight shine through and seeing nothing but one element, not a bunch of things mixed in. It means unmixed, composed of a single element. When you buy fruit juice, how many of you go through this process? You go and buy fruit juice. When I was an intern in Oregon back in 2002 in Portland area, I had to do grocery shopping for myself. And I went to the grocery store and I went to buy some juice. And I like real juice and exotic fruit juices. I enjoy that. And maybe some mango juice or some passion fruit juice or kiwi juice. I like that kind of stuff. And I saw a bunch of little frozen containers of these kind of tropical fruit juices. And so I bought it. They were on sale for like 33 cents a piece or something like that. Now, looking back, I know you're never going to buy any kind of form of 100% juice for 33 cents a canister. But I bought it, and I was enjoying it, drinking it, and then I realized one day, I looked at the ingredients. It was like 3% juice, and most of that was apple juice. And the rest of it was high fructose corn syrup and this kind of stuff. I was duped. It wasn't pure. It wasn't hardly anything there, actually. I'm burdened that your motives and your hearts are pure. I'm in the same boat. We want to serve God together. Sometimes our motives are not pure. We like to be noticed. We like to be recognized. And these things, it's all part of growth. And I recognize as a pastor, I'm not waiting for you to be perfect in your motives to put you to use. We're growing together. Right where we're at, we're all going to move forward 100 steps. Some of you are going to pass me up. But I'm burdened that your motives will become more and more genuine. Like a child. It's just so amazing to me, the older we grow, the more my goal becomes childlikeness. The more I know, the more I want to be like a child in my faith, in my ways of life. I want to be simple. Not simple as far as unthinking, but simple as far as life is very simple to me. It's not complicated. It's not complex. It's simple. I'm burdened that you grow in purity, increase in pure motives, that Christ would live in your hearts. Christ is in our heart. But let me ask you this question. Is he thoroughly at home in every room? If I walk into every compartment of your house, your thought life, is he 100% there? Or are there some rooms that are just not really comfortable to him? Does God have full reign in your heart? Are your motives pure? Letter B, I am praying that as you prepare for the judgment, you are developing in spiritual maturity. He says, and without offense. The matter of being sincere is the idea of purity for yourself. You yourself having the right outlook and perspective, a pure, one-focus heart for God. But then this matter of without offense is the idea of a carefulness for others. Not being a stumbling block. How many of you have ever walked along a road or a path or a hallway and you didn't know that something was laying there? For me right now would be some child's toy that was supposed to be put away. And it wasn't put away, and I'm walking along, and I step on it. And I trip, and I fall down. And I get a little bruise, and I get a little upset and worked up. Hopefully I don't, but you all know. I'm praying that each one of you would not be that for other people. And that that would be true of you more and more and more. I don't want your life to raise questions about Jesus. I don't want your life to raise questions about wholehearted living for Jesus. I don't want your life to be a stumbling block, to be something that people could look at and say, that's hypocrisy. We all have some of that, but I'm burdened as a pastor that that will increase, that we will not be an offense. Number three, I am burdened that we grow in our purity, in our spiritual maturity, and let her see that you will be prospering with spiritual fruit. The outcome of a pure, non-stumbling stone life is a life that produces results, a life that accomplishes things for God, not just is good, not bad, but a life that accomplishes things, that produces results. What are we talking about here? When we talk about spiritual fruit, the only other places in the Bible where the fruit or fruits of righteousness phrase appears, to my knowledge, is James 3:18, where it says, "And the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace of them that make peace." A person has the fruit of righteousness in his life of causing the right thing to happen on a regular basis because of his life. That happens as a person goes about seeking peace, not discord, not disunity, but peace. Are you a peacemaker? And the only other place in the Bible I see this phrase is Proverbs 11:30, going back to the Old Testament. It says, "The fruit of the righteous is a tree of life, and he that winneth souls is wise." Let's turn to that verse, because I want to show you something here. I'm going to give you a little Hebrew lesson, if that's okay. I want to talk to you briefly about what Bible study students learn is what it's called Hebrew parallelism. How many of you have heard of Hebrew parallelism? Any of you? What does parallel mean? Who would like to give me an answer? Mara? Identical. Two lines that are parallel, or two ideas that are symmetrical, perfectly straight beside each other. And if you drew those lines out forever, they would never intersect or get farther apart. Well, Hebrew parallelism kind of balances ideas out. There are different forms of Hebrew parallelism. But when you read a proverb in the book of Proverbs, what usually happens is you have two halves. The first half and the second half. The first half and the second half usually work together, either to build, the first part either builds and tells you more about the first part, or the second part kind of balances out the first part, okay? Hebrew parallelism. That's how you read Hebrew poetry in this form. If you look at Proverbs 11:30, what does it say? The fruit of the righteous is a tree of life. And in the other half, and he that winneth souls is wise. And in this case, the description of the person is in the first part of the first half and the last part of the second half. You see that? The fruit of the righteous, a righteous person, and then he that winneth souls is wise. Righteousness and wisdom are counterbalanced here. They're placed together. A righteous and a wise person. And if you meditate on this passage, it would be helpful for you to think about righteousness and wisdom, how a wise person always does what is right. A wise person always causes the right thing to happen. And it's something to meditate on. But what about the middle part? If the outside parts balance each other, what about the inside parts? Is a tree of life, and he that winneth souls. What are the outcomes? The tree of life and winning souls. A wise, righteous person produces a tree of life, winneth souls. Do you see how that works? The ideas, the concepts? That's Hebrew parallelism. Now I've got you all interested in doing the whole book of Proverbs and looking at each one, right? When we talk about spiritual fruit, it is very right for us to think about the fruit of the Spirit. Love, joy, peace, gentleness, long-suffering, and these kind of things. That is very right. And in fact, part of what the Holy Spirit produces in our lives is the fruit of the Spirit. These qualities, these tangible but somewhat subjective qualities about us. We are quick to turn the page and focus on spiritual fruit from the fruit of the Spirit standpoint, and we're not usually quick to focus on the fruits of righteousness specifically in regard to winning souls. Why? Why do we always want to attract the attention to the fruit of the Spirit? I got convicted about this as I meditated on it this week. I had to meditate on it because when I did this phrase search, these are the only verses that I found. And so I had to take them seriously. Why are we quick to jump to the fruits of the Spirit and not really... winning souls, but yeah, fruits of the Spirit is also part of it. Don't forget about it. Why do we do that? Some whispering. Anyone want to volunteer? Maybe our outreach guy. Why don't you just tell us why you think? Yes, the fruits of the Spirit are not necessarily as tangible. We think that we can fake it. We can act loving. We can act kind. We can act gentle, at least at church. But you can't just make people convert. That happens. And it's very objective. It's very clear. I want to ask a question that I've been asking myself, Josh, and Vlad, we've been asking ourselves. How many people are we reaching? I can talk about my love and my peace and my gentleness and kindness all I want. But has anyone been taken from the kingdom of darkness to the kingdom of righteousness because of my life? Am I living in such a wise and right way that the rightest thing that can ever happen is happening, that people are doing what is right because of my life? He that winneth souls. It's an interesting phrase, this matter of winning souls as a fruit of righteousness. Doing what is right produces winning souls. The idea of winning means to capture, to take away, to seize, and to collect. So a person who wins souls is a person, whether Old or New Testament, whatever you want to look at here, it's a person that captures souls from the kingdom of unrighteousness and captures them into the kingdom of righteousness. It's a person who lives in such a way that finds ways deliberately and as the result of their life to see people seized from the enemy and won for the victor. People taken from Satan and given to God. People that are collected for God, by God, through our lives. How many souls has God collected for His kingdom through your life? I really want to avoid counting numbers and getting into this whole, what I might call soul-winning hoopla that can take place. Take what I'm saying with a grain of salt. Counting numbers and making quick decisions. I'm not talking about that. But honestly, folks, I am spiritually hungry for a church and for a pastor who is so in tune to the heart of God that I talk to people about Jesus a whole lot more because that's wise and right. And as a result of my increasing love for God and for others, more and more people are turned to what is right. If we just keep it very simple, that's what this is talking about. And there's not a person, teenager, young person, or adult in this room that can't be used in that way. I'll tell you, my children, Josh and Emily this week, they have gotten something. They're growing in a lot of ways. But one thing that I appreciate about them that's been positive lately is their heart for souls. I was encouraged to see the Vasquez boys out yesterday passing out tracks and loving it. One of them actually ate one of the track corners off one of the tracks. That's good. Some of us could get a little more aggressive ourselves. But wherever we're going, we have a little stack of children's tracks about how to have the greatest friend or something. And it walks through the wordless book, and we put little Faith Baptist stickers on the back. And we have to have some in our van right now because our kids, when they get out somewhere, they want to pass out tracts. And we're at a restaurant, and if they're kids, they want to go over to the kid and give them a tract. And then I have to explain what was going on. It forces me to talk to the parents, which is a very good thing. They're not overly concerned about the religious background or the appearance or the scariness or any of this thing. They just like to give out these tracts. Could we all grow in that way? Say, Lord, I want to be wise. I want to be doing what is right. And certainly, when you put all that together, I needed to be telling people about Jesus all the time. And God, I may not have the faith to believe it, but I want to win souls. I want people. I want disciples. Give them to me, God. You make it happen. I will take the steps, but you give them to me. I am not concerned about this church. If 5 years from now, and that's a very unbelieving milestone, I should say 1 year, and that's probably unbelieving too, but if 5 years from now, all of us have somebody, at least one. And that's probably very unbelieving. Have one person that we've won from the kingdom of darkness to the kingdom of light, and we've pulled them into the better kingdom. We've seized them. We've collected them for God. I tell you what, I'm not concerned about this church if all of us have had that experience. Because you will, and I like Carl has used this word with me before, you will be pumped. That's a very Mr. Roberts word. Are you pumped? Are you pumped because of what God is doing through your life and the lives of people? I'm starting to get pumped. I'm not pumped like I should be, but I'm starting to. How does this happen? Let's close by this thought. This doesn't happen by sheer human willpower and effort and strategy. This happens by the enabling of Christ. Very clearly, the Bible says in verse 11, being filled with the, and that's probably not just one person getting converted, being filled with the fruits of righteousness, which are, and I'm going to add a word if that's okay, only, the idea, which are only by Jesus Christ. It is through Christ that these things happen. That's why this love for God, this carefulness, this drawing near to Him, this loving on Him with our actions and making choices for Him is so important. Because it's that love that draws you near to Him that enables Him to be free to work. It is by the enabling of Christ, by the enabling of Christ. John 15, 4 through 5 says, abide in me and I in you. Let me live. Let me make myself at home in your heart is the idea. Abide in me and I in you, as the branch cannot bear fruit of itself except it abide in the vine. No more can ye except you abide in me. I am the vine. You are the branches. He that abideth in me and I in him, the same bringeth forth much fruit. For without me, you can only do a lot less. Is that what it says? Without me, you can do nothing. I think one of the reasons why we're doing nothing for Jesus is because we're not living with Jesus. We're just living our own selfish lives and humoring Him at church on Sunday. We're not all in. And He's not all in us. And why do we even want to win souls? Why do we want to have the fruits of righteousness in our life? Not for personal reasons, but for the only good reason that exists. I don't know of another one. Unto the glory and praise of God. God deserves it. So we need to draw near to Him. He deserves for what He did. We talked today about His substitutionary death. What a moving worship service. It deeply moved my heart. Let's not go home and try to recapture that emotion. Let's go talk to someone about it. Let's go spread the gospel. The Ohio team is in a prime position because they have to do that this week. I want to give two challenges here. The rest of us, let's pretend we're on a ministry team in New York City here this week. Let's talk to some people about Jesus. Let's show some love to Jesus and some love to them by doing it. And Ohio team, let me challenge you. You're not off the hook. When you're done with this trip and you go back home, don't leave the ministry trip. This should not be some special event that's a spiritual high for you. This should be a spiritual low and a spiritual starting point. There's not a young person in this room who shouldn't be fascinated and in love with Jesus to the point where nothing else really matters. You'll change your whole life pursuit because of that. There's no detail you won't overhaul and give away and stop and change and improve because you just are fascinated and in love with Jesus and you want to see people won over to that perspective. Don't let it end this week. I want to share this verse with you. I'm going to focus on the second part of it. Hebrews 13, 17. This talks about how people should handle a pastor in his role. It says, obey them, Hebrews 13, 17. Obey those who rule over you. And that's not ruling like a king. That's simply having administrative responsibilities. Obey those who rule over you and be submissive, which takes a lot of grace. For they watch out for your souls as those who must give account. Let them do so with joy and not with grief, for that would be unprofitable for you. Many of you have fed me well already. I could tell you all the food I've eaten here already, and I'm like Pastor Sawyer now already, and I'm only a week in. I've had so much food and so much good food since I've been here, and there's more coming. You don't have to feed me well. You don't even have to stay awake through all my messages. You don't have to be here for necessarily every single service in the world. You don't have to be perfect. But I will say this, if you can take what I've preached to you this morning seriously and learn to apply truth a little bit more out of love and to prepare yourself for the judgment seat and be serious about reaching souls, when I go to bed at night, I will be a happy person. But if it's not there, I'm going to be a praying person. And Lord, would you do it? Because that's what I want for Faith Baptist Church. Let's read Philippians 2, 1, 9 through 11. And this I pray, that your love may abound yet more and more in knowledge and in all judgments, that you may approve things that are excellent, that you may be sincere and without offense till the day of Christ, being filled with the fruits of righteousness, which are by Jesus Christ, unto the glory and praise of God.